This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. And today, a true fan favorite, Bo Jarvis, president and CEO of West Group.
This is the third time Bo's been on the show. He was gracious enough to come down to the studio. I feel like this was a fantastic conversation.
Yes.
And it, fantastic in the way that it was an hour, a little over an hour, however long we went. We kind of covered everything from politics to economy to real estate narratives to investing. But it's very exciting to hear Bo's take because, like, he's talking, you know, they do layoffs, which we talk about. West Right. Group is kind of between West Group and Rennie. They're the two kind of very
public
layoffs that have happened, laying off 12% of their jobs. But West Group is this, a company where when they make layoffs, the federal government calls Bo.
Yeah.
The provincial government calls Bo. So he's got insight that not many people have. And it was fantastic hearing it. And not to mention, he's a super bright guy, obviously. So it was great talking to him.
It's one of those conversations where you're like, I could do this for the next 3 hours. There's a lot to cover here, but also I'm just really enjoying this conversation and hearing what he has to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're recognizing that Bo's a very busy guy. So we kept him for an hour, but I think we fit a lot into this hour conversation. So
I've gone and went back to many different aspects of this story and thought, wow, that's an interesting, you know, I want to dig deeper into that. I want to think more about that. So it's like reading a book where you read a paragraph and go, man, there's like 15 ideas in this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. And great five wire too.
Yeah. No, always. Always. We didn't even get into the skiing past, I feel like. But go back if you want to hear more about
that. Yeah, he's got a great story as well. So anyways, but before we get to that, Matt, of course, this episode is sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our real estate team in Vancouver. And I believe we have a segment that remains nameless. That's a trivia segment.
That's right. We have a segment. And I do have a trivia question today, Adam. It actually relates to single family homes. But before I get to this single family homes trivia question.
Yes.
I did want to bring up a single family home showing that you had this week on the east side.
I think
there was multiple offers on this house.
Yeah. The house will remain nameless.
Close to a library. Let's just put it that way.
Well, yeah. It was one of the more uncomfortable showings. This has never happened to me before. Middle of the day.
Are you serious? Let's get to the story.
But the middle of the day, we're standing, we're on the top floor of the house. My client, husband and wife.
You're overlooking commercial space.
We share a commercial alley overlooking the commercial space and we're getting the views of the commercial retail, right? And on top of the, what I believe is a library, there are two people, I would say this is about 12 noon or so.
Right.
Right. On like a Tuesday, call it.
Yeah. Nice day though.
Beautiful day too. Two people on the rooftop that are around late 40s, early 50s.
Right.
Look totally normal.
Our folks.
Start making out on the rooftop.
That's a bit strange.
Yeah. And we acknowledge that they're on the roof. We're kind of looking out at the view. And then it's like, oh, there's people on that roof. And then all of a sudden they start making out. And it's like, oh, they're making out. And then as we're kind of staring out at the view, the makeout progresses.
You said to me, like, they're not just making out. They start like going at it. Like really making at it.
And then I swear, like broad daylight,
a sex act happened.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say, reminded me of playing the jazz flute in high school.
This is a true story. This happened like 3 days ago.
Yeah. Like in the middle of the day and we're all like, whoa, whoa. It went from like, wow, those people are making out to like, holy.
Oh my God.
This is indecent. So, yeah. And anyways.
They're in the privacy of their own library rooftop. So,
Yeah. Anyways,
let's get to the trivia question. Okay. So, Adam, I was wondering about, you know, we're summer months. I was wondering, at first I thought, how many single family homes in the city of Vancouver have sold? But then I got looking and I came up with this trivia question. So we're talking West Side and East Side. In the last 30 days, what was the largest percentage price drop sale recorded over the last month? Percentage wise, and bonus if it was dollar amount. Was it the same sale? You make your guess.
But before we get to that, Matt, of course.
Right, Adam. We do have a new listing. I want to highlight this one. This is an amazing new listing. And talk about value. We've been talking about a lot of listings that are exceedingly good value right now. This listing can be found, of course, at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, 102-4788 Brentwood Drive. This is right beside the amazing Brentwood. It's that Ledmac building just to the east of the amazing Brentwood. It's a master plan community from 2008, wood frame, four stories. You look at it and you go, man, this was built right before they decided 60 stories made sense in Brentwood. But fantastic complex. Of course, I mentioned Ledmac. They're a renowned builder. Two bed, two bath, the outdoor space. So this is 102. So it's ground floor, Adam, but it's high up off. So there's no right. security concerns. You're kind of removed from low heat highway, but you still have an amazing outdoor patio with a spot to grow. I think our seller was growing strawberries and they still there. So
not,
this is
not where I thought you were
two
going.
Bed, two bath, great outdoor space, priced at $674,900 for over 800 square feet, two parking, one storage, fantastic offering right in the heart of Brentwood beside the mall. So
yeah,
check
I was
it out. Look,
I was looking at this listing and I mean, all the benefits of a garden suite without the negatives.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that you don't get the any security concerns and you're right in the heart of Brentwood. So right. it's kind of an amazing spot. You know, some might say unicorn, Adam, because of that outdoor space in that urban environment. Check it out at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Click on our featured listings. While you're there, Adam, hit sell with us because you can download the sold plan. That's start on launch date, our most downloaded PDF of all time to get your home ready for sale, your home or property. And we'd love to help you with that. And that's click with sell with us at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
So back to the trivia question, Matt. And please remind listeners just quickly. What
okay,
is the
yes,
question?
So basically, I went back a month.
Yes.
In the city of Vancouver, I looked at all single family sales. There's 60
east side,
odd
west
sales.
Side.
East side, west side. What was the largest percentage price drop sale over the last month? So we're looking for a percentage.
Listing.
From listing price to sale price. That's right.
Oh, I'm going to go a big drop because I feel like there's a lot of, how big of a drop? So that's for detached. So got to be probably more than 300 grand.
Bonus if you can say west side or east side.
I'm going to say west side and I'm going to say 20%.
Pretty good. It was the west side.
Yes.
It was 18.68%.
Aha.
The list price was 298.
Ooh, lower
yeah,
than I 2. Thought.
2.98 and the sold price was 2.438. So $560,000 price drop.
Okay.
It wasn't the biggest price drop in dollar terms. That was close to 900 grand, 849,000. That was over in Oak Ridge.
Surprising to see it in more the entry level detached market on the west side.
On the west side. Yeah, exactly.
I was expecting more around 5 million bucks.
There were three over asking single family home sales in the last month, all on the east side, all under 1.8.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe that.
That's, yeah. That's, so it's kind of, it makes sense, right?
That market's no joke. It's a lot of pressure kind of under the 1.8.
Well, yeah. And from your story, there's a lot of pressure building.
Boom. All right. What else do we got, Matt? I guess we could jump to this conversation with Bo.
This is a
great one.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase here. Bo Jarvis, everybody.
This podcast is sponsored by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been nominated for Multifamily Builder of the Year for 10 consecutive years and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. you're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with two fitness areas, three children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Okay, so we're here with Bo Jarvis. He's the president and CEO of West Group. How you doing, Bo?
Doing really well, thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. And I think this is third time
past guest on the show.
Favorite for sure.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I love being doing this podcast.
Awesome. Maybe can you start by telling our listeners that haven't heard you on the show before? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, yeah. President and CEO of West Group Properties. And West Group is one of the largest privately held real estate development companies in Western Canada. We're involved in all facets of real estate development, a lot of housing, industrial, office space, retail, purpose-built rental, for sale housing, kind of high-rise, low-rise, everything. Promiscuous in the market is what I like to say. And I oversee the operations, I guess, the strategic direction of the organization. But really, I have a leadership team that is second to none, and they do everything. Awesome. So I come and do stuff like this now.
Right. Man, pretty good. Well, Bo, how's the market?
The market? Oof. I would say the market is probably in the most challenged place that I've ever seen in my career. And it is, the headlines are the headlines, right? Where we're starting to see workforce reductions, layoffs, job loss, canceled projects, postponed projects, reconfigured projects. Vancouver and Toronto, housing starts diminishing significantly. And, you know, I think I should actually make a little point there. So housing starts as defined by CMHC. So last June over June, housing starts in Vancouver went up 70%, but that's actually not true because they measure a housing start when a foundation gets to grade. And so sometimes on these big multifamily projects, it's about 2 to 2.5 years before we get to grade. So that housing start was actually two and a half years ago, in terms of investment decision and breaking ground. So we're actually collaborating with CMHC and the government on that data. But housing starts are down significantly. Investment has dried up. Capital is an issue. Liquidity, it's in crisis. But I think we're almost at the bottom.
You made headlines last month calling the layoffs at West Group one of the most difficult days in the company's 60-year history. Can you walk us through what led to that moment and how you were approached making such a tough decision?
And we should say it was 12%?
It was 12% on that day. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 12%, just for context for people that weren't following along on LinkedIn and I guess in the real estate news, significant layoffs at West Group.
Yeah, that's significant for sure. And yeah, how did we get here? I guess is kind of what you asked. And we've been in a pretty challenged real estate market from a real estate development perspective and a delivery of housing perspective, a delivery of job space perspective for 5 years. And we've had a tremendous, if not unprecedented, amount of government intervention, which we've talked about on this podcast before, by all levels of government as a result of the housing crisis, what I now like to characterize as a cost of delivery crisis rather than an affordability crisis. But because of that, ongoing interest rates, construction cost inflation, taxes, fees, and levies from various levels of government making up 30% of the cost of new housing. And it just, everything compounded and sort of culminated into this situation where we stagnated in terms of a market. Where there's no absorption. People can't afford to buy what we're trying to sell. It's at a cost that nobody can afford. And, you saw on the industrial market and the office market, all kinds of softening occurring there. Obviously, work from home and hybrid work strategies that came out of COVID has really caused issues in the office market. Industrials come off. And so, everything we do effectively has been challenged, with the exception of purpose-built rental. Which we are, huge. We're a large developer of purpose-built rental and one of CMHC's largest partners on the West Coast. So that's been very strong. With that said, we're starting to see a softening there as well. So we did everything we could during those period, or the last 5 years, to maintain our talent. Our talent is just paramount, our people, and we have built a really great culture at West Group that attracts and retains talent. We really spend a lot of time on that. And so over the last few years, as we were waiting for the market to kind of pick up and stabilize, more certainty, more stability, we were operating on, call it, on the merchant side of our business, condo for sale, pre-sale. You operate in a deficit as you're working through these projects, and most companies do this because you carry a large amount of overhead. And then, you work through a big lump of condos or pre-sale townhomes, whatever it is. And then they all close and you pay back a few years of operating deficit plus your profits and you kind of start again, right? Because there's no even flow of housing delivery. It's lumpy.
Right.
That's just how it works. And what happened is that period extended in terms of getting these housing units delivered. And this is not isolated to West Group. And so it's not sustainable to continue operating in this sort of deficit from an overhead perspective. And we were actually selling off some non-core assets and things like that from our balance sheet to make sure that we could continue to pay our people and keep everybody. We really wanted to keep our talent. It's really important to us. We also took on a little bit more debt. We have very, very conservative thresholds for our balance sheet in terms of debt to equity, and we were quite disciplined in maintaining that. We breached some of those thresholds, again, to generate liquidity and keep our people. But it wasn't sustainable any longer. And we had to make it was a terrible decision. It was horrible. And it's anybody who has to go through that in a large kind of way like that, it's just shitty. And so that was about a month ago now. And we're just trying to sort of stabilize at the moment and carry forward.
What do you think it means for the industry kind of more broadly? And I mean that from West Group is one of the most established players in Vancouver. I know land banking and things like that. You guys are very well positioned. If you're laying off 10, 12% or however much it is at this point, where do you think everybody else is at?
Well, there's been a number of quiet workforce reductions from names that you know. So that's already been happening. We were, ourselves and Rennie were kind of the first to kind of be a little bit more public about it. Because frankly speaking, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice as an industry by quietly doing it. I don't know, at this point in time when our industry is literally bleeding out, and this could have been avoidable, right? So back to the leading up to the decision, it's really disappointing because when we've been engaging with government, all levels of government over the last 5 to 10 years, we've been saying, if you do this, here's what the end result will be, right? And it's been this death by a thousand cuts until here we are, right? And this could have been avoided. And so you're seeing, it's already occurring. It's happening on the general contractor side too, quietly. And I've been advocating with my colleagues and peers in the industry to be public about it, be respectful of the people that are departing. And we did everything we could to try and help them out. We put it out. That's one of the other reasons we went public, was to let people know that there's people from West Group, really good talent,
right,
that are departing. And, if you have work or jobs, let's connect you. We've actually started connecting a bunch of the people, and some of the people are starting to get picked up, which is really cool. So that's another reason to be a little bit more public about it. But you know, we are one of the best positioned in the industry. We have one of the strongest balance sheets. And so if we're going through this, everybody's going to be going through it. And indeed, you know, there was the article that came out in the Globe and Mail, I guess about 2 weeks ago, and there were more people added to the list that were, you know, Polygon was on there. Neil Crystal was interviewed. I think he's been on this podcast before. People in Toronto, groups in Toronto with significant layoffs. And so, you know, it's interesting because about within 2 hours of the announcement, I got calls from both the provincial government and the federal government.
Really?
Yeah. And so, you know, that tells you something because we're sitting here collaborating, engaging, whatever you want to call it, advocating for the last 5 to 7 years, 10 years on all of this crazy policy intervention and then job loss and boy, do they perk up. So that means something. And so I found that quite interesting.
Were they surprised? Was it like, or was it just like, okay, we just heard the news and we want to check in and kind of take the pulse?
I think they are surprised. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Is there a disconnect? Because I mean, Matt and I talk about how we feel like we're in an echo chamber. It's sometimes hard to, because I mean, you still go to a cocktail party and people are like, how's the market? Like, you guys must be busy. And it's like, are you, have you been paying attention? Clearly don't listen to the show.
We're doing three a week now.
Just to keep busy.
Disconnect in this, like what's happening in the industry. Like, I feel like going public with something like this, you are sounding the alarm a bit in a way that I think is meaningful, like you suggest. But do you feel like there's a big disconnect between what's actually happening in the industry and what the general public sees?
I think there's a huge disconnect. I think we're starting to bridge that gap. That's been our core objective, my core objective in advocacy efforts. I literally wrote this down on a piece of paper, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, because we're huge into advocacy. We're just front and center developing our own channels into the province, into Ottawa, et cetera, working. Like we support and we collaborate with industry associations. We've obviously been on boards and I was the chair of UDI, but we're really kind of moving forward on our own. And about 10 years ago, I wrote down on a piece of paper that I want to take the word greedy from out in front of the word developer. I wrote that down. And sure enough, in 2024, we saw three newspaper articles with the words greedy government. You know, one was the National Post, one was, I think, Globe and Mail, and I don't know where, you know, but I think we're starting to bridge that gap in terms of the reality versus sort of contrary to popular belief, let's just call it. And so, you know, I spend a lot of time now and, you know, I get made fun of in the office for this, but I dive into the Reddit threads. I don't generally participate, but I observe because there's a lot going on there, right? And in the LinkedIn conversations and on Twitter X or whatever, and you dive in there and you can see the different sentiments and the different perspectives, and you can see quite clearly that there's a disconnect for sure with what's going on the ground versus what's perceived, right? Mm-hmm. And there still indeed is a perception that, you know, developers are, you know, making billions and millions. There was a counselor from a city in the Lower Mainland that was on CKNW. I believe it was the Jazz Johal show that, you know, they were advocating for making a policy change that would be impactful to the delivery of housing. And Jazz Johal said, you know, I think it was either Simi Sarah or Jazz Johal said, you know, what about, you know, how will this impact developers or landlords or whatever? And she said, this counselor, the elected official, you know, I'm not worried of them about them. They're making billions and billions. And I immediately reached out to her and I said, I would like to have a meeting with you. You just said this. You're an elected official. It is entirely irresponsible of you to be saying that like that without understanding what's going on whatsoever. And we met and had coffee and I brought like performas and data. And I said, like, you can't say that. Educate yourself. Yeah. You're an elected official. You have a higher level of responsibility. So it's extremely challenging. It's a time where we're trying to bridge that gap with the disconnect between, you know, when you're at the cocktail party and someone says, oh, you guys are probably killing it right now, right? And it's like, no.
Yeah, I brought a brown paper bag lunch.
Yeah. I'm 40 of old English in a brown paper bag.
Exactly.
Yeah, the OE is my lunch.
I think we kind of covered it, but you know, we're talking about kind of Reddit threads and LinkedIn and general impressions. I just wanted to go back. So when the federal government and the provincial government, who you've been loudly advocating against, I guess, is that how you'd say it, or advocating to, and cooperating with, when they're surprised though, that feels like do you think there's just a fundamental distrust still that kind of comes from that, oh, greedy developer, or you know, an industry that, you know, whiny industry or whatever the narrative is?
I think there is. I think it's deeply rooted, right? If you think about this, like the greedy developer narrative has been something that has been almost generational,
right?
And so when you and politicians have seized on that narrative, they have said, I'm not going to meet with developers and pander to developers. Like it's been something that has been politicized, and you've attracted votes by saying that, and now you are held accountable to those constituents who voted for you because you said that, without really understanding that, you know, a developer is just delivering roofs over people's heads, or you know, we're also creating jobs and taking risks, and there's people that, you know, there's thousands of jobs on our sites every day, from electricians to architects to drywallers to development managers, project managers, et cetera, right? And so I think that, you know, that is also rooted in the bureaucracy in many respects, and in the what I refer to government apparatus, right? Mm-hmm. This sort of ideology. And so we've been sort of step by step, increment by increment, trying to educate and be really open and transparent about things to help people understand, and doing it in a meaningful way. Sometimes it's a little blunt, but really like it's to grab attention a little bit. But if you kind of peel that initial bluntness, there's a whole layer upon layer of transparency. And that's how we've been trying to do it, is be super open, super transparent. Back to the, you know, the Reddit threads and things like that. We've found LinkedIn to be quite interestingly impactful with advocacy, especially with the business community and government, in fact. And so we've been using that tool, and I do dive into the comment sections there and start, you know, respectfully debating with people. It's definitely not, you know, Twitter X in terms of the vitriol that you find there. It's much more, you know, like toned down on LinkedIn, and you can have a bit of a debate. But I debate with people sometimes, and it's just, you know, it's someone who is, you know, you just can see their title and what they do on LinkedIn, and they have nothing to do with our industry, yet they are debating with me as if they are an expert. And
just two president and CEOs going at it.
I usually don't call it out like that. I just try and engage. And then what I typically say is, look, if you'd really like to come have a conversation, I'd welcome you to come to my office. I'd have coffee with you. I'm happy to show you all of our dashboards. Again, we're super transparent. Some people disappear because they don't want to hear it. It's an inconvenient truth. Some people engage, and I have coffee with them and I show them. And so, yeah, so it's a long answer to your question. It always is with me, a long answer to anybody's question, but there is a disconnect. We're trying to bridge that gap. I think we're making some headway.
Now, is there still a disconnect with, like, I mean, the provincial government has to be looking at this and recognizing some pretty negative trends here. And I would imagine there's a sense of maybe panic about some of the decisions that have been made. Or is there still a disconnect there as well?
I would say, like, the provincial government, they have, and we've talked about this on this podcast before, they've made some moves with policy that we as an industry, in fact, advocated for. Some of them, I think, are working out, and some of them have yet to work out, or I don't think are working out. An example of what is working out is removing public hearings from development housing applications that are compliant with an official community plan. right? You're not relitigating anymore. That is a massive policy shift that is extremely helpful. The amenity cost charge ACC policy, I can't remember what bill that was, that is supposed to create certainty around density bonus payments and community amenity contributions. I don't know that that's really working out that well. And that was intended to create stability, certainty, and rigor around how all of that is happening. And so as we move down the path here, I do think that there's still a pretty significant disconnect between the provincial politics and bureaucracy and what is happening on the ground. You know, we conveyed that if we keep doing this, there will be job loss. You know, I had a beer with Premier Eby at Christmas, and it was a really great conversation. There was no agenda. I was really grateful that he gave me that time. He's, you know, I actually like, there's things that I like about our premier, and then there's many things that I completely and fundamentally disagree with. He gave me that time. It was funny. I said, you know, I'm probably not at the top of your list to have a beer with, a Christmas beer, and I really appreciate your time. He said, you're not at the bottom of my list. But, you know, I conveyed to him recently that there are things that can be done that we need to do right now that you're not acting on, and our industry is bleeding out. And, you know, I know he's reading. He doesn't respond to me. He's the premier of the province. I'm just a dude. And when we did the layoffs, I said, you know, here's what we just did. And I indicated to you in the text above that our industry is bleeding out and there are things you can do that are immediate and they're not being done. And now we're doing this. And so there is a disconnect. You know, they also just did a cabinet shift. So there's a new housing minister as of last week, I guess. In our industry, and I would say speaking for our industry right now, because I've spoken with many of my colleagues, has some questions about that decision. Because there's a voting track record at City Council in the City of Vancouver regarding housing, and there's commentary that you can go and you can see on video council meetings.
It's public.
And there's quite a history there. And, you know, we're in the midst of, like, we're laying people off. Polygon's laying people off. Other developers who you know have already done so. General contractors are laying people off because developers aren't starting projects. And so this new housing minister really needs to come in and really understand what's going on the ground to snap into action here is the message. Because there's some questions about the track record.
Do you see any logic? I mean, first off, the general shuffle, right? But to have Ravi Kalon on the file for a couple of years, he's probably feeling like, okay, I fully understand what's going on now. He came from, you know, an entirely different area.
Yeah.
And at a time where basically we're in, you know, as you describe it, essentially crisis. It's like, okay, pull the rug out from under him. Yeah. He goes elsewhere and it's like the new person who's got to, even if the track record was fine, has to relearn everything.
Totally.
Like that's so is there a logic to this that involves housing at all? Or is it just like unfortunate circumstances?
We're all questioning what's going on. You know, again, I actually like Ravi as a person. I can have a conversation with Ravi and it's a really nice conversation. Do I agree with all of his decisions on the housing file? Absolutely not. Do I think that he could have acted faster and done more? Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know what was behind this decision. He's moved to jobs, which is obviously a pretty important file right now. And maybe it demonstrates that they are concerned about jobs in general. But we're all sort of going, why are we doing this right now?
Yeah.
And because Ravi absolutely had generated a strong understanding of what we needed to do. Now, politically, did he have the will or the support to do some of the things? That's a whole different question, right?
What about at the federal level? Is there anything you're optimistic about? Or
I'm glad you asked that question. I am optimistic about the federal level. So we were the same week that we engaged in our reduction of workforce at the end of the week on a Friday, we flew to Ottawa. We started a group that it's just eight of some of the largest home builders in Canada from across Canada, BC, Alberta, Quebec, and Ontario. We started based on the premise that we are making the investments, we're on the ground, taking the risk. Stop engaging with academics, associations, and I have nothing against the associations, right? They're doing a great job. But when it gets to nuanced, complex policy around taxes or whatever, they're not, you got to go directly to the source, which is the developer, the builder. And so we said to them, like, enough, right? Like, you guys, how is it that you feel so comfortable putting out policy for our industry and just having us react or defend against it? Whereas with aerospace or big auto, would you ever put out policy without speaking to the executives of that industry to understand what the unintended consequences of that policy might be? And they all just, when I ask that question, just like I said it right here, and they stare at me like a deer in the headlights. And I say, let's look at agriculture. I say, and I'll tell you about Ottawa and get to the answer, but look at agriculture. You know, agriculture goes into a drought. What does government do? And I asked this question of a whole bunch of people in Ottawa, and they said, well, you know, we support. Housing is an industry and it's in drought. And yet you want to add like vacant land taxes and you want to penalize us because you don't think we're working fast enough or whatever the case is. Like, we have to shift this mindset. And so this new, I'll say, federal Liberal government is, notwithstanding there's many of the same actors, my observation is they are acting very different,
right?
Like, very different. So we created this group that is 8 developers. You know, you talk to us, you don't talk to the academics. Enough of this bullshit. We want it, like, you need to hear us. You need to, don't even announce a policy politically or otherwise without talking to us first. There's no time for unintended consequences anymore, right? We've gone from crisis to acute. And so we went and met with them. We had a 3-hour meeting with 55 government officials on a Friday in Ottawa, from like finance department, housing, economics, jobs, CMHC, everyone. And it was incredibly productive. Like, it was awesome. Huh. And then we went into an hour and a half meeting with the housing minister, Gregor, who we obviously know from Vancouver here. And we're quite stoked, actually, that he's the housing minister. And I can get to that in a minute. But we met with him for an hour and a half. And then we went back and met and re-caucused with many members of the previous group for the morning. So it's Friday of the long weekend. The offices are full. These people, these you know, the bureaucrats, they're texting me for information at midnight their time, like, consistently. And so the question was, are you optimistic about what's going on in Ottawa or whatever? They are different. They are acting. They are active. They are trying. And they sent us, and it's the first, like, we gave a big submission when we went there for that day of things that, here are the issues, here's the solutions that we think, let us explain them to you in detail. They circulated all of that and sent us back super detailed questions. And I've never had that happen before. Wow. We submit shit all the time.
Right? Into the void.
Yeah. And it was like, holy cow. And we've spent the last couple of weeks actually answering those questions as a group, and we're sending them in tomorrow, the answers to those questions. And they've also asked our group to make a submission for the fall budget, the federal budget. And we're just finishing that up right now. So again, long answer, always these questions are long answers, but there's something that's different there. They are active and they are working hard.
Why? There's a couple of questions out of here, but one is, why is the housing, why is the development industry not taken seriously the same way of, like, in previously not being consulted in the same way? Is it something organizational, or is it like that there hasn't been enough lobbying, or what is it?
I think one of the biggest things, and we said this, is we're a very fragmented industry, right? So the biggest home builder in Canada, which I think it could be, is it Mattamy perhaps, in Toronto, delivers like 3% of all housing in Canada, right? And so you think big auto.
Yeah, there's no GM.
Yeah. Right? And so we're fragmented. And what a developer does needs, what works for someone in Quebec doesn't work for someone in BC. BC is the only province that has the Real Estate Marketing Act,
right? And so everything is just chopped up and different. And you got people that are building lane homes and single family homes, and you got people that are building high rise, and you got, you know, everything in between. And so I think that's one of the primary reasons it's been challenged. And then we have, you know, we have UDI, who's the most prominent industry advocacy group here in BC. And in Ontario, it's like Build, or, you know, it's a different type of group. And there's then there's ULI, there's NAOP, there's all these different associations, RealPAC, and they're all kind of trying to vine for space and vine for that pathway into Ottawa to be at the table to advocate. So I think that's the primary reason why we've been treated differently. But I also believe that that narrative, that ideology around the greedy developer is quite pervasive, right? And I think that's part of it as well. They haven't respected us. They haven't respected our industry for the risk that we take, what it is that we're actually doing, again, putting roofs over people's heads. And we've been the go-to sort of monster, or the enemy, villain. Right? The villain, right? And and we're starting to change that. And so now we're being heard more. We're being listened to. Respected, I guess.
So does it, at the federal level, that's kind of really exciting and probably speaks to just how the federal government's kind of changed and taking everything on, which is exciting, I think. For listeners out there that don't kind of understand the different layers of the feds, the provincial, the municipal, what does that actually mean, like on the ground, that they're taking those actions for a company like West Group?
I mean, it's huge, right? So you all, each level of government has different levers they can push, pull to help. Obviously, municipal governments are responsible for land use, urban planning, and then development cost charges and community amenity contributions, and there's that. The province comes to the table in various ways because there's legislation, or call it policy, law, that we have to deal with that's like Ministry of Transport, Environment, things like that, fisheries, ocean, that goes to the province. Fisheries could be federal, actually. And I'm getting all the departments wrong because they've changed the names from DFO to this to that. And so the province, but the province also is in charge of the municipal government act and the Vancouver Charter, right? So they can start to put pressure on local levels of government and regional governments to make some changes. And there's quid pro quo that goes on there. And then the federal government, I really think one of the biggest roles the federal government can take is with the words that it uses. And taking a leadership role with how it talks and how it speaks to housing and the industry as a sector, et cetera. And then the second big thing where the federal government comes into place is capital. So CMHC, you know, I think it was recently reported, is literally involved in 58% of all starts or something like that. And I don't know if it was British Columbia or Canada or whatever, but it was some crazy stat where, you know, if not for CMHC, nothing would be getting built. And so, and a plug to CMHC and the federal government in this regard, like they've really, really come to the table with their RCFI, which is now ACLP. So previously stood for Rental Construction Financing Initiative. And now it's changed to ACLP, Apartment Construction Loan Program. That program, which is effectively the same program, new acronym, is literally responsible for delivering more purpose-built rental housing in our country than since we were building with the MURBs in the 70s. And they really deserve some credit for coming to the table, because I do think we'd be in a very different place without them. So again, that's how the federal government helps, is through CMHC and through data and statistics and taking a leadership role.
Want to talk about Gregor?
Yeah.
I'm on a first name basis with him. Yeah, just your take, because obviously former mayor of Vancouver.
Yeah. So Gregor, I think that it was a great choice for housing minister. I think number one, having a high profile cabinet minister at the federal level from Vancouver is good, right? And it helps convey what's going on here, because we are very different here, right? And so I think that's very positive. The other thing is, and I'm going to say this very just candidly, he has the most experience in housing out of any federal cabinet minister. I don't care what you say. And this idea that we can just put people in who, you know, have a law degree, or they taught politics at, you know, Toronto Metropolitan University or whatever it is, and they can just be the finance minister, or, you know, of a G7 nation, or the housing minister. Like, come on, this is ridiculous, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so he literally has the most experience in housing out of any cabinet minister in the federal government. The reasons for that are, when he was mayor of Vancouver, he was the one who spearheaded STIR, or, you know, whether he spearheaded or his council, which I guess was Vision, or, you know, or he supported staff spearheading. I don't know how it all worked, but STIR was short-term incentives for rental housing. And that was basically, acknowledging that there is an imminent rental housing crisis. How do we stimulate rental housing? What can we do at the local level if the province and the feds aren't stepping in? And that was getting rid of sort of development cost charges and giving density for rental housing and different things. It was a pilot project and it really worked. And that turned into Rental 100, which was also Vision Vancouver, led by Gregor, which turned into the policy that we have today on incentives for rental housing in the city of Vancouver. So he was on that before it was even a thing in Canada. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he was involved in Nexi, which was a prefabricated panel system. It didn't work out, but the federal government is all over this prefabrication and modular and trying to get this all going. We can have a whole separate podcast about that. But he can bring a wealth of experience from that, you know, not working out for what reasons and what have you. So I think it was the best decision that they could have made. I think he's got to probably get his, being the mayor of Vancouver and being the federal housing minister and debating and all that is a bit of a difference. He's probably got to figure all that out. But yeah, that's how I feel.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, "the rep," and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much, and we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a Caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
I feel like there's been, over the last few years in this downturn, There have been almost like green shoots off in the distance where people have been like, well, wait for the interest rates to come down, or wait for this, wait for that. Right now, what do you think? Like, what does it take right now to turn the market around?
Stability, right? So certainty. When interest rates started to come down, let's go back to last sort of September, October. We started to see sales center traffic pick up a little bit. We weren't absorbing. This is obviously on our for sale product, but the traffic was picking up a little bit into November, even more. last week of December, first 3 weeks of January or so, probably did. We were all of a sudden doing like 9 to 12 deals a week, which for us is like, that's like beautiful. That's like the sweet spot. It's like a tempo mode, you know what I mean? And when you're just kind of breaking ground on projects and you have 3-4 years to deliver and you go into that tempo mode like that, it's just like heavenly. I feel like we haven't been there in a really long time. So then when Trump was inaugurated and, you know, I think Liberation Day or whatever with the tariffs, it just sucked the oxygen out of the room. And it's been nothing since. And so you have this tariff conversation, and I don't even know how to have that conversation. And then, you know, the federal government, then there was an election, and everybody's like, well, we're going to wait and see what happens with the election and the results of the election. And then what are their policies going to be? And so sure enough, they come out and say, we're going to eliminate GST for first-time homebuyers, which, you know, frankly, does not go far enough whatsoever. We're advocating for that. But that hasn't come into, that won't come into effect until they resit in Parliament in September, October. So if you're a purchaser right now, you're like, well, I remember what happened with capital gains. It was there and then it wasn't. And now, and like, I'm waiting until this is law and I'm going to then go and write a contract with a developer at a sales center. And so it's just like, it's purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to get out of purgatory. We need to get out of this box before things can start to turn around and we see green shoots. So stability and certainty.
Is it, so when you say before we start to see green shoots, because I think we had Neil Crystal on who saw little green shoots.
Have you talked, have you talked to him today?
No.
Yeah, that was a long time.
Yeah. So basically what we're saying today, we're aspiring to green shoots.
Yeah, I would say we're aspiring to green shoots. You know, look, I am optimistic about the fundamentals of our market and our industry, right? From a supply and demand perspective. And it's just trying to, you know, if we look at building code changes and fees, levies, and taxes by all levels of government, you're talking about close to 40% of the cost of new housing.
Mm-hmm.
That's all government. Building code, fees, levies, and taxes, 40%. If we can start to like make changes there, we're going to start to be able to build housing at a cost that people can afford. And we're going to start to move again and unlock. And so I feel like we're on the cusp of that. So maybe that's the green shoot. From a policy perspective, we're on the cusp of some change.
And so, and that, just going back to this cost of delivery crisis, that's where the cost comes down, right? The 40% is what is malleable in the inputs.
Think super malleable, right? But you know, there has to be, government is sucking and blowing. And they say that we want to double output in terms of, on an annual basis of housing in our country. Yet they're taxing the shit out of it, right? Like you look at...
housing is cigarettes.
Yeah, it's like a sin tax, exactly. Yeah. And so, and it's crazy because we embed all this stuff in the cost of housing. So development cost charges, community amenity contributions, all this kind of stuff. And we just flow it through to the end user, whether they're a purchaser or a renter. At the end of the project, the province and the federal government come with property transfer tax and GST, and they tax all these other levels of government taxes. There's double taxation going on. And so we have ideas as to how to fix it, and they're nuanced and it's complex, but I think they're really strong ideas and government is currently considering them. But if we can make some change there and start to just bring down the cost of delivery, I think we're going to see some movement. We're going to see some unlocking.
So, you know, everyone in real estate talks in terms of market cycles. Is this a regular market cycle or is this cost of delivery crisis created something else entirely?
That's a good question. I'm going to go with, I think this is, it's where we're, it, this is different. I mean, I've only been alive for 50 years and probably only 30 understood anything about anything.
Yeah.
And in the last 10 years, you know, really understood anything about anything. But, I don't know. I feel like housing has become so politicized. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there has been so much policy. Because with politics comes policy. That's like policy follows politics everywhere politics goes. And so we have had an unprecedented amount of government intervention, whether, you know, whether it be in the form of taxation, building code, social engineering, honestly, right? Like, so the province was trying to make every single unit we build have a certain accessibility standards, which was going to make every unit 5 to 10% bigger and cost that much more. They backed off on that. But there's social engineering, there's everything. We've been trying to solve all these different crises on the backs of housing. Look at climate, right? You look at all these other industries that get tax credits and subsidies to solve, you know, look at Volkswagen, and they get like subsidies and tax credit and low interest loans to create electric vehicle battery plants. We get taxed. They increase the taxes, right? And then they increase the building code and to deal with climate, and they just pass all these costs on to new homeowners as opposed to any level of subsidy, any level of tax credit. So housing has been used to just solve all these issues and just sort of like, oh, the market will absorb it. The market will bear it. And that's what's now just falling apart
before. So I'm just thinking here, and we've asked this question to other people, but the whole model for market condo townhome construction is based on pre-selling 60-70% of the building usually to get the financing. With what you just said, does that model still make sense in that you need people to buy with the idea that 4 or 5 years down the line, they won't only just have a house or a condo, but it will actually potentially be worth more than it is today? Does that still make sense in your mind, or do we need a new model, or do we go back to 2017 at some point?
And just to piggyback on that, how easy is it to get investors back interested in this market? And not to overcomplicate things.
No. This, and there's the podcast.
Really long answer question. Holy cow. So those are really good questions. So the pre-sale side of things and the banks and how we finance construction and meet a pre-sale test as required by the bank, including requiring us to have a profit. Right. And so does that model change? It's a pretty good model, to be honest. So 25 years ago, there was no such thing as a pre-sale. A developer would build on spec and they'd go get a construction loan, but it was a much smaller construction loan because it was building on spec and there was way more risk. So this idea of a pre-sale, you're de-risking the project, right? And you're able to get more construction debt because the project is de-risked. Therefore, we're having to put less equity in, which means these projects are more capital efficient. It's a more capital efficient way to deliver housing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important. Now, can things be tweaked? Yes, they can. Like OSFI, which is the regulatory body for the banks, I think they're causing all kinds of problems and that needs to be opened up. And we're not talking about that enough. And they're restricting the bank's capital from being deployed. And there's a whole conversation there. So I think the pre-sale model with the banks and how they do it is the best model, most capital efficient way to deliver more housing. The investor is a big part of the pre-sale, right? And I love that you asked this question because we vilified the investor. They became the villain too. And we forgot about the fact that investors sponsor projects, mm-hmm. right? So we put a project for sale and end users come, first-time homebuyers come, and investors come. And some investors rent their units out and put them into the rental market, which is really good. And that's called the shadow market. And the shadow market is a big part of our rental market. And so we push those investors away in a big way. Investors, you know, they don't want to touch this stuff right now because they've just been, you know, we have flipping taxes and speculation and vacancy taxes and tax. And really, if you think about it, why not let an investor come, put their capital into our project so it gets built, and then who cares whether they flip out of it and make a little bit of money, or even better, put it into the rental market, right? And if you really want to, if you really want to say, okay, like Australia's model is allows the investors to come and buy purpose-built or new product. They can't buy existing product, they can buy new product. So investors are sponsoring the delivery of
new housing.
Yeah, they
can still help.
Yeah, I think they may restrict occupancy so that it has to be put into the market for rental or occupied by that purchaser, I think. So there's ways to deal with it through occupancy restrictions, et cetera. But we just push them all away. And so that's created a huge issue. And I think that it's just this irony or a paradox of it all, right? Where, you know, no, housing should be for people, not investors. Investors are getting the housing built for the people.
Right.
Right. And so we have to be honest about this. And that's something that I see, you know, you go into the back to the LinkedIn, chats and comments and Reddit and all that. There's still a very divisive conversation happening there about investors and homes, end users or whatever.
It does feel like, you know, thinking about the kind of narratives, the multiple narratives we've talked about today, like advocating for allowing foreign buyers back into the market feels like that's just, it's like political suicide, even for the development community in a lot of ways. Like, it's like that, that's just one bridge too far, even though I feel like it's obvious and it makes a ton of sense. And just like you said, like, you know, whether or not they actually come back is another question. But it's interesting that way.
We should be inviting as much capital into our market as possible. I mean, you look at the Fraser Institute came out, I think they said that to meet CMHC's targets, we need $1.6 to $1.8 trillion of capital. And I've said this a few times publicly, that's like $300 billion a year in capital that's currently not in the system by 2031 or 2032. Where's that capital coming from? Right. And I think CMHC suggested it's $2 trillion. So and not only have we been pushing the investor away from housing and housing projects, we've been pushing capital away from Canada in all sectors for a decade, right? With it's too risky. We fundamentally don't respect a risk taker and then the return that is demanded for that risk. We don't respect that, right? We just want people to come take the risk here in Canada. And then when the return comes, whoa, that's not fair. That's not fair. Right? It's like tall poppy syndrome, right? The one poppy grows a little bit taller and chop, right? And so we have to celebrate risk taking. We have to celebrate innovators. We have to celebrate people who are willing to risk capital and expect a return for that. We have to be teaching that. We got to teach that in our schools, and we have to teach that to our kids. Like, and so we went astray there, I think.
I'm just thinking maybe shifting gears just a little bit.
Yeah.
We're coming up on an hour here, Bo, and appreciate your time, by the way.
I'm happy to go for another. There's so much.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's probably more stuff that might come up around policy, but maybe shifting gears kind of to the market. Like, one thing I'm curious about is we've talked a lot about this. What's your take on downtown and just in the resale market right now in general?
I remember Bo Colt said downtown was the buy.
Yeah. And I mean, we felt and feel the same way, but now I'm looking at like some of the prices on Marina side and some of the prices at like Shangri-La and like all these, you know, we're talking like between 1,000 and 1,100 a foot for waterfront.
My thesis has only like come to fruition more.
Yeah.
I had people when you asked on the last two times I was here, you know, I said like invest in downtown condos, look at the discrepancy between what they're selling for today versus what we would have to deliver for. And that gap's only grown. I look at this all the time. You got, you know, units in Marina side at King's Landing area or whatever, and they're overlooking the Burrard Street Bridge on the 21st floor. They're bigger two bedrooms like we used to build, like 1,250 square feet. And they're like, $1,300 a square foot. Yeah. And I think it is. And so for us to build that new, we'd have to sell that for $2,800 or $3,000 a square foot. And so that gap, that won't persist forever, right? Yeah. The cost of delivering new is going to come down, but those units, the values have to go up too. They just have to. And I think that it's been a, you know, like we had an exodus out of downtown during COVID. There's obviously a lot of social issues in that have spread beyond downtown East Side, right? Mm-hmm. We have mental health issues, drug addiction issues. There's a lot, and that's creating an environment, I think, that people have become less tolerant with. And so they're leaving downtown or moving out or whatever. But downtown Vancouver is a pretty beautiful place, and it's going to be there, you know, for another 400 years or whatever the hell it is. And so I think that we have to believe in downtown over the long run. And I think, yeah, it's a great buy right now.
Yeah. It's like the pricing similar to, I was just looking at something at what Nanaimo and Broadway. You're like, oh, downtown pricing over here. Like, downtown's still the spot, let alone Surrey or whatever else you're talking about. But
in real estate, they say buy the rumor and sell the news. What's the rumor or something that you're monitoring that you think people should keep an eye on?
The rumor. That's a good question. I don't know what the rumor is. I mean, the rumor is watching what government does at this point. Like that honestly is, I think, going to create... Which is crazy to think, right? Like that where everything is resting on what's government's next move. Because I don't know what else there is right now.
Are there areas in Metro Vancouver you're excited about outside of downtown right now that you're kind of looking at saying like, okay, I think, you know, once we turn a switch back, and I think there's going to be a lot of activity coming to this area or region?
Yeah, I mean, so we have a large master plan community in Port Moody.
I was going to say, you guys did really well at the launch, right?
I feel like it was one of the most successful launches in Canada in 2024. Yeah. There just hasn't been much new product coming online there. Yeah, Port Moody's awesome. And people were super interested in the product that we were offering there. Long-term master plan community is going to take 10 to 14 years to build out. Views of the inlet and a really great city. Previously, when I was at Awny, we did a large development there called Suterbrook, which was, you know, did really well and was really well received at the time. And so, yeah, I'm pretty bullish on Port Moody. It's a really cool city, and it's got a great vibe and great people and great community.
Is it worth talking about the benefit of buying early on in a master plan community? Because this, like the inlet district, I don't want to turn this into a plug, but it's worth kind of outlining exactly.
We call it the pioneer discount, right? So when you buy, and I would say that in every instance, so I've been involved in master plan communities since the start of my career. And in every instant, when you bought in the first phases of a master plan community that can be a 10 to, you know, River District's probably like a 25-year build out. Yeah, it's pioneering. Because you're buying into a promise, right? That there's going to be all these amenities in the future, and there's going to be these parks and walkways and all these buildings that look like this. Yet, this is the first building that you're buying into. And then there's going to be construction around you for the next 10 years. So I would say that typically those units are discounted to a degree at the beginning of a project, master plan. And it is, you buying in, you're getting a pioneering discount.
I think I might know the answer to this, but one of your five kids approaches you and says, "Dad, I want to make an investment in real estate in Metro Vancouver. Where should I buy?"
I mean, I'd probably go, the quick thing that I go to is back to downtown. Buy a condo. You know, some of these buildings are 15 to 20 years old now, and you know that they're having special assessments and there's parkade leaks and there's these different things going on. And you gotta dig through that. I think there's some buildings that are performing better than others. And so you need to understand that. But I think that's probably the quickest place that I would go if there was a sort of a gun being held to my head. Yeah. I mean, there's some incredible opportunities on land and even assets. I'm actually quite contrarian with office. I think that office will come back. I think, you know, BMO just took out 3 or 4 or 5 floors in our building in Bentall downtown. And my understanding is they need more space already. And, you know, like they're calling people back to work, whether it's 3 or 4 days a week, and they're like, oh, we need more space. I think that you're going to start to see that a bit more. So I think on the commercial investment side, you know, I think people should be looking at land, be looking at office assets for sure. Hard to value land right now, but there's some good deals.
Maybe as a final question, Bo, what's one piece of advice you'd have for a seller right now thinking of selling in the next, call it 1 to 6 months? And a lot of people are right now kind of struggling with questions around selling in this market. So,
yeah, I mean, I'd honestly say if you don't have to sell, don't sell. You know, you're seeing record levels of inventory, both pre-sale and resale markets. You're seeing record levels of available land. You're seeing, we have the most amount of court-ordered sales and receiverships we've seen in our market in well over a decade, decades. And so, yeah, it's just not a good time to sell if you don't have to. If you do have to sell, you got to be realistic about the market. You just got to do your research, but be realistic, because there's a lot of, we look at a lot of things for sale, and there's a lot of things that are just for sale and it's not at a realistic price given the circumstances and the timing. So quick advice is hold off if you can.
All right.
Fantastic. Maybe we'll leave it there, but we do have this segment called the 5R5 lighthearted questions to end the show.
They haven't changed. So.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area, because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure, an all-around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's J-E-T-H-R-O condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours.
Question number one for you, Bo. What's a book that you've read recently that you would recommend for our listeners?
I'm almost done Men and Rubber, which is the Harvey Firestone story. I think it's called Men and Rubber, The Story of Business or something like that. Shane Parrish from the Knowledge Project podcast and Farnham Report blog, he republished it or something. It's his number one recommended book. Fantastic book.
And it's about Firestone, like the tires.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. It's such a good book.
Oh.
And then Demon Copperhead.
Oh, I've heard of that one. Yeah.
Book. Yeah. More on the fiction side of things. That's an excellent book. Yeah. Those would be my.
Hey, those are good. In the last few years or since you've been on the show, maybe what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? Sailing?
No. Probably. I can answer this. I was just talking about this with an old friend on the weekend. Trying to surrender more. I'm a control freak. You know, life is just getting thrown at you every single day in every which way. And I think you kind of have to surrender to it, absorb it, and just work through. It's like every single thing's a lesson. And why am I being taught this today? Yeah. Let's work through it.
Especially in big picture, even more so now than, I feel like if we were having this conversation in 96 or something, we'd be like, oh man.
Yeah,
like this is so stable and beautiful and perfect.
Yeah, probably a little bit late 90s. But it's just surrendering. Just like, and it doesn't mean you don't fight, you don't advocate, you don't resist. But just like, okay, it is what it is. Like, how are we going to get through this? Instead of, I can't believe I'm waking up again and this is happening. You know, which I definitely was most of my life. Like, so.
What have you been binge watching lately, or a movie recommendation?
Oh, well, I don't know. I was always a fan of Black Hawk Down, and there's a movie that just came out and I can't remember on what service or whatever. It was called Warfare. Really, really well done. I mean, if you were into Black Hawk Down back in the day.
Is it actually a Is it?
It's a film. Yeah. Not a series. Okay. Yeah.
Series. I mean, I'm binging on all kinds of series. I mean, I've become a bit of a Taylor Sheridan. Is that his name?
Fan. Yeah.
You know, and he's got the Yellowstone franchise and all that. Yellowstone's great and everything, but Landman with Billy Bob Thornton is just fantastic. And then I've become quite a fan of the Lioness Special Ops series.
Is that him as well?
Yeah. He did Sicario, those Sicario
I was going to say, that guy comes up with a series every 3 weeks.
It's like, yeah. So I don't know. Those are fun to watch, but.
Right on. Adam, you're into Mobland right now.
So Neil Crystal, that was his recommendation.
I think I told Neil about it.
Okay. Well, it's full circle.
So Guy Ritchie and Tom Hardy, that guy is a talent.
Yeah.
That's actually a great show.
I think I'm about six deep, but I'm really hooked now.
Yeah.
The first few of them, I think they've announced,
and Pierce Brosnan
is great.
I think they've announced, Helen Mirren, I think they've announced there's going to be another season of that already.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
What are you listening to band or music wise these days?
A song that I feel like I've kind of, sometimes you're listening to a tune and you just kind of hit rewind and listen to it again every once in a while. It's a song that my daughter actually showed me several years ago and it became one of my favorite songs. It's Santigold, Chasing Shadows. Yeah, great song. Are you familiar with Santigold? I think originally from Brooklyn, maybe. I don't know. It's just a super talented artist. And then the other song is one of like my all-time favorites. And I found myself listening to that the other day. It was The Weight by The Band.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's just like, man, that is literally the best song in the world.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Big band fans over here. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a book, eh?
Yeah, actually, that's a good recommendation. Robbie Robertson's book.
I haven't read that. Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, up in Woodstock and the whole... They used to crash cars every week in, week out. Yeah, it was... It's a great book. It's a great book.
Is it just Robbie Robertson, like a biographer?
It is. It's his, basically a memoir.
Was it The Last Waltz? Because there's a show.
No, that was the documentary with all the, with Bob Dylan and Neil Young and everything. Yeah. This is like the, growing up, he's part Indigenous in Toronto.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And then he goes by, he's like 15 or 16 when he goes and joins.
Joins like the guys that are all about 7 or 8
like
years
in
older
Arkansas, playing guitar with them. And it's the whole story, It's pretty good. But the amount of the drugs and booze, it's pretty interesting. They were the backup band for Dylan when he went electric. It's pretty good.
Yeah, that song, The Weight. I mean, it's just like, brings tears to my eyes sometimes listening to that song.
Last Waltz, also the Neil Young.
The cocaine.
The visible cocaine on the YouTube. That's
worth checking out. last but not least, something you have purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life since the last time you were on the show.
A weight vest.
Oh,
okay. You're in good company. Adam's, are you wearing yours right now?
I own one. Yeah. I don't use it. That's why it looks like I'm wearing a weight.
I've been using it. It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
You're not doing like the gross grind or something.
No. I'm definitely not doing the gross grind with it.
But it's like walk the dog type
stuff? No, I work out with it on.
Oh, wow.
I do the whole workout.
Holy.
I don't know.
It's a next level.
It's advanced.
I don't know. Okay. Man, I turned 50 in December. I gotta turn up everything for longevity here. So I'm just going for it.
Yeah. Right on.
Oh, that's great. Well, Bo, how can we find out more about what you're up to? And of course, West Group.
You know, as I said earlier, we've been pretty active on LinkedIn.
You and Brad are very active.
Just kind of found a bit of a space there. And it's not, to be honest, you get a bit of a dopamine hit there when you do that, but it's not something like I said to my team, one day I'm going to turn off my LinkedIn account because it's not something I'd rather be doing real estate development and running a business, right? And being a leader and this advocacy. I mean, I think we do it more than we do real estate development. And I don't know that that's where you can see what we're up to for the most part right now anyway.
Somebody out there is listening. If you're commenting on Reddit, are you doing it under your real name?
You know what? I've never commented on Reddit. I definitely go into the chats that I read. I comment on LinkedIn.
You might be wasting your time on Reddit, honestly.
Yeah, Reddit is pretty wild. And we also, for the listeners, we put out a YouTube channel called Homes Don't Just Happen, where we do the illustrated explainer videos of housing. We just put our recent one out on mass timber. So that's a really great sort of way to, again, back to education, trying to bridge that gap between reality and perception in terms of real estate, housing, construction, development. So that's a really great way to see what we're up to, as well as Homes Don't Just Happen.
That's a great one for agents listening as well. Huge for product knowledge. Awesome. Well, Bo, thanks again for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
There you have it, folks. Our discussion with Bo Jarvis, President and CEO of West Group.
Always great having Bo on the show. And man, Bo's an inspiration. I feel like, you know, he's just got back from a really awesome trip. He was telling us about 5 kids.
Yeah.
He seems to handle life really well. And on top of that, super bright guy.
So, yeah. And you know, he sent an email. I don't know if he's talking about on the show, but I think he did. He said he wrote down the goal to take out greedy from greedy developer is kind of changing the storyline. And he sent over something from the Toronto Star, I think, where it was greedy government as opposed to greedy developer. And it just makes you think how important those stories, the stories we tell ourselves, how it impacts policy, investment, the way that we organize society is all based on narratives. And I think, you know, Bo's doing God's work trying to change those.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think this is kind of, this is all part of it, right? Like, I feel like he's been on an ongoing media tour for a few years, kind of talking to everybody he can. And it is super important work, because if you're trying to organize and share and help shape a narrative that is actually a correct narrative. Yeah. I mean, it's like, and I think that's the most wild thing, is because I get lost in the comment sections every once in a while on Reddit or on Instagram or Facebook or wherever, right? LinkedIn. And it is unbelievable how many people are commenting so passionately without actually truly understanding
anything
how housing about is anything. Created.
Yeah.
Right. It's just, it is very frustrating.
But you know, and you think, like, thinking about that narrative, you know, Bo talked on the show about the cost of delivery crisis, and there's that 40% of the cost where there's some potentially some play there if people get on board. So I think it makes a lot of sense spending a lot of energy getting the word out. So yeah, kudos to Bo. And yeah, just I learned a lot. Honestly.
Also very, very stoked to hear about Gregor and the federal government right now. That's that was all positive. So
no kidding.
Anyways, some good news there.
What else do we have before we cut for the day, Adam? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer where we're sending out the episodes. We're sending out stats, the type of stats where, you know, often the quiz questions come from, to be honest. Also sales ratios, where you can dig into different price bands, different neighborhoods, really dig into the details. Of course, we're heading into August, a slower period, but it's good to get started on learning a market if you're interested in getting involved in real estate. That's over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And we also have, of course, an even better tool, arguably, private client services.
Yeah, Matt, because if you're not using PCS, you are standing still where the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor-level information for free. It's available at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. All you have to do is head over, click buy with us, sign up for your own free account. Lots of people taking advantage of this research tool right now. And honestly, I'm seeing, like, it's funny, but I think Greg from Rennie was talking about, he had an interesting tweet about kind of like...
Oh, on LinkedIn,
stabilization happening right now. Talked to a few people that's, you know, like, I feel like listings feel a little bit busier right now.
Actually, at the national level, for sure, I feel like the narrative's changing and the markets are kind of shifting. Vancouver and Toronto maybe a little bit behind.
But. And if there's a trade deal that comes out of this, and like, I mean, you could see potentially, you know, we've all been talking about wills, the second half of the year be stronger than the first half. I'm going to put my money on the second half.
Absolutely.
Anyways, I don't know how much more inventory we're going to be seeing this summer.
No, it's like slowing down, right?
Yeah, the inventory push is out there. So, and still, you know, it's funny, but you were saying like the sub 1.8 East Van, we were talking about that in the intro, is still really busy in certain segments. Like there's always pockets, right? But there, the markets we're watching kind of continuously, you know, in Vancouver that are still balanced. Inventory is just brutal. It's hard to get good inventory.
And when good inventory comes up, for instance, over in Burnaby in Brentwood, that new listing we just launched, like people are lining up.
Yeah. we're there a number of times in the next week.
Yeah, a number of times. So it just speaks to those submarkets.
Absolutely. So Matt, if people want to get in touch, how can they reach out?
778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
We'll have a great week and we're back next week with another fantastic episode.
Take care.
2000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.